another edition of the Edgington Post show. It's me, Mark Edge, and I'm here for Free Talk Live with a very important person. The gentleman's name is Aubrey de Grey. He is from Trinity Hall, Cambridge, is where he's got his degree. But I think more importantly, co-author of Ending Aging, Aubrey is the foremost expert on longevity. Aubrey, can you hear me?
I can hear you well. Thank you, Mark, for having me on the show.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for coming again. So I guess the first thing we should talk about is, what is longevity?
Yeah, so the word longevity has become the kind of the main word that people use to talk about the field that I work on. But it's actually not a particularly good choice, because we already know exactly what longevity is. It's length of life, you
right.
know. So then we can refine it a little bit. We can talk about healthy longevity, you know, the length of life you have before you succumb to one or another of the chronic progressive conditions that, with current medicine, once you get them, you don't get better. Of course, the way the word is being used these days is in terms of the biomedical work being done to extend healthy lifespan and, of course, total lifespan, healthy longevity and total longevity.
Right.
That's what I do. I'm interested in the biology of aging, and I'm interested in it not curiosity-driven like thing where I just want to understand it, but rather as something to be addressed. Because I have always believed that it is by far the foremost problem for humanity, the thing that causes by far the most suffering as well as the most death. So yeah, to me, even though the word is kind of overloaded at this point, it's just the quest to bring aging under comprehensive medical control.
Right. So I feel similarly. Once I did the interview with you, I was shot into another world. I didn't really understand it before that. Who really thinks of extending age? But once you started talking about it, it all began to make sense as the foremost problem. And here's what struck me, was that if I can take these geniuses, these great men, these people who can accomplish this, that, and the other in whatever field they're in, and I can keep them, then we're going to have these leaps forward. They're going to work with other great men that come along in this field. They're going to collaborate. They're going to have synergy. They're going to do more than they would even do by themselves with this next generation of great men. So if you can imagine that magic moment in time where Socrates and then Plato and then Aristotle came along and they were able to work together, if you could have that in every field all the time, well, that's really special. I do like the term health span to describe, you know, healthy aging and things like that. But when you talked about aging as a disease, that was really life-changing for me.
Yeah, well, so of course, I actually don't like to call aging a disease, because that word, again, has connotations that are not all accurate. In particular, the issue with calling aging a disease is that one thinks in terms of curing it. One thinks in terms of, you know, developing some kind of medicines that could be given to the person once and they won't suffer from aging again. Whereas, of course, aging, since it is a consequence of being alive in the first place, it's not something like an infection. You can't do that. You have instead to manage it as a different kind of medical problem. So I'm certainly happy with calling aging a medical problem, but I'm a little bit uncomfortable with calling it a disease. Calling it even a medical problem, however, as you correctly say, is something that a lot of people like find novel. And I honestly find that bizarre. And it took me a while to understand why so many people get this wrong. It's essentially because of the way that people have essentially avoided thinking about aging. The only thing one can really do in a world in which aging is this inevitable thing that is definitely going to happen at a reasonably predictable age, and it's really horrible, is to try and find some way to put it out of one's mind and get on with one's miserably short life and make the best of it. And there are essentially two ways to do that. One thing is to say, well, it's kind of a blessing in disguise, you know, and to invent, you know, these completely ridiculous reasons why the elimination of aging would create problems that would be even worse than aging is. So there's a wide variety of those, as I'm sure you remember. And the other way is to say, well, you know, aging is not like other medical problems. It's kind of woven into the fabric of the universe, and it's not something that's even like in principle, amenable to medical intervention. This leads to completely idiotic appeals to the second law of thermodynamics, which has absolutely no relevance whatsoever. Things like that. But the point here is that aging is absolutely a medical problem because it can absolutely be addressed by preventative maintenance. All we have to remember is that the body is a machine, albeit an extremely complicated machine that we understand very poorly, and therefore that its function, whether that means how it looks or how it feels or how it works, is defined by its structure at the molecular and cellular level. Now, that structure changes over time as a consequence of the normal operation of the machine, same as it does in a car that accumulates rust or, you know, whatever. So just like cars, we have the potential to develop interventions that will keep that under control. The reason we have cars that are 100 years old today is not because the cars were designed to last 100 years, not at all. They were designed to last maybe 10 or 15 years. And yet here they are. And the reason is because preventative maintenance actually works and completely transcends the warranty period of the machine the way it was designed to last maybe 10 or 15 years. It's exactly the same. And the fact that we don't understand how the body works turns out to be of very little relevance. Look, we understand, of course, some things about how the body works, but every biologist will tell you that there's a vast amount that we don't understand. And I would certainly agree with that. But the thing is, if we can actually characterize the changes that happen, we don't need to understand the details of how they happen. We just need to reverse them, repair that damage so that the damage doesn't reach a level that exceeds the amount that the body is set up to tolerate without significant decline in function.
So tell me about this preventative maintenance. I guess that's the first thing, is that people probably should be living a healthy life and doing preventative maintenance in order to age more slowly. What is that?
Well, so first of all, living a healthy life, you know, living the way your mother told you to and so on, is definitely a good idea, but there's only so far it can go. It's a bit like, you know, only driving your car in dry conditions and not in the rain. It still rusts a bit more slowly than normal. So that's not good enough. What we want to do in terms of preventative maintenance is actually turn back the clock, not just slow down the rate at which damage accumulates, which is what lifestyle might be able to do a little bit, but to eliminate damage that's already accumulated. So what that amounts to is identifying, first of all, what the damage is, classifying all of the various types of damage into a manageable number of categories, which is something that I first did nearly a quarter of a century ago now, the year 2000. And then for each of those categories, identifying an approach to doing this damage repair. For example, one type of damage is the loss of cells of certain types, especially stem cells. These cells will diminish in number during aging because they'll die and not be automatically replaced by cell division. So we fix that by putting in new stem cells that know what to do to divide and form and replace cells that the body is not replacing on its own. Similarly, there might be, there are, for example, various types of molecular waste products that the body does not know how to either destroy or excrete. And those waste products accumulate. We can develop mechanisms to help the body to either destroy them or excrete them. And that's gone quite well over the years. It's something that I've pioneered more than 15 years ago, and I'm very pleased with the progress that's been made. So you get the idea. There's a variety of different things we need to do because there's a variety of different types of damage. But it's all, you know, an engineering problem, really.
What are some of these treatments that one can get that would potentially lengthen life? I mean, is anything working yet, or are we still in the let's find out phase?
Well, so first of all, we have to remember that because there's lots of different types of damage, this is fundamentally a divide and conquer approach, right? So no one therapy can be expected to lengthen life more than a very small amount, even in a laboratory organism like a mouse, let alone a human. We have to look forward to the world in which we're getting a lot of different interventions at the same time applied to the same people for different types of damage. But the good news is that, yes, a number of these things are not only we understand what we need to do, but we can, to some extent, already do them. There are clinical trials going on, not just in the laboratory, but in people with various types of stem cell therapy, for example, and with various types of what are called senolytics, which are drugs that selectively kill off cells that have got into an aberrant state, often called a zombie state. Similarly, the thing I just mentioned, getting rid of waste products, that's already moved forward some years ago into not just being done in academia or in nonprofit organizations like my own, but rather as actual startup companies. and in one case relating to macular degeneration, which is the number one cause of blindness in the elderly, it's actually in the process of being sold to Big Pharma. So, you know, this is moving forward quite well. There's still other types of damage that have not gotten nearly that far, and there's work to do to get them that far. And that's largely why my focus over the past decade or more has been exactly on those most difficult types of damage, to get them far enough along that other people will start to, you know, carry the torch. But now we are, my foundation, LEV Foundation, are actually doing the next step, which is to do the combining of the easier ones, the ones that are already working reasonably well in mice.
So what is this LEV Foundation?
LEV, Longevity Escape Velocity. It's a nonprofit. It's a 501c3 headquartered in California. And we do research. We're interested in funding and sponsoring work to hasten the medical control of aging. We don't do any of the actual work on people, the clinical trial stuff. By the time it's got to be ready for clinical trials, it's become interesting to other people. But flagship research program is to take various things that already individually demonstrate a degree of promise in mice and to put them together and see whether they do better in combination than they do individually. The main thing that we're interested in is focusing on damage repair, of course. And that means that we don't treat mice throughout their lives. We take them when they're already in middle age, which for mice basically means they've got to be about a year and a half old. These mice that we use normally live to about 2.5 years. Then we throw the kitchen sink at them and we see what happens. The first such experiment in that research program began a year ago. I'm in the fortunate position, because our work is funded entirely by philanthropy rather than by grants or by investors, so I don't have to worry about, you know, publication priority or, you know, intellectual property. That means that I'm in the position of being able to put regular updates out on social media, talking about, you know, how many mice are surviving and so on. I do that every month or so. And I'm very pleased to say that the experiment's going rather well, that the mice that are getting all four of these treatments that we're currently looking at are doing not only a lot better than the mice that aren't getting any of the treatments, they're also doing a lot better than the ones that are getting just one of the treatments, which we're doing as sort of control experiments.
Control, right. Yeah. So what are these four treatments? Are you allowed to talk to them?
Absolutely. I mean, in the same way that I'm putting out these updates, and for anyone who wants more detail than what I'm about to give, of course, this is all on our website, levf.org, which I imagine you'll be able to put in the show notes or whatever.
I shall.
The four interventions, one of them is not actually really a damage repair intervention. It's just one that is very well established, and we wanted to use it to compare, and that is rapamycin, a drug that was discovered on Easter Island a long time ago and has been used in immunomodulation in various ways, but which was discovered something over a decade ago to be a very good calorie restriction mimetic. In other words, a drug that tricks the body into thinking that it's not getting as much food as it expects, even when it actually is. And this drug has been shown, just like calorie restriction itself, to extend the lifespan of normal mice, even when initiated relatively late in life, the way we're doing. The other three are very much damage repair. There's one drug that's a senolytic. I mentioned senolytics a moment ago, drugs that get rid of these things called senescent cells. There's one that is a gene therapy, adding telomerase to these mice. Telomerase is an enzyme that's responsible for maintaining the cell's ability to divide, and that's very important for stem cells. Mice actually already make quite a bit of telomerase, but it turns out that having more is still beneficial, and that was demonstrated by a number of groups, well, at least a couple of groups over the years. And then the final one is what's called heterochronic bone marrow transplant. So this means we take a bunch of young mice, we extract their bone marrow, and we give it to old mice. And the idea here is that the stem cells of the blood in the bone marrow don't behave so well in older animals. So if we can replace some of them with young ones, then they may do better. And again, this was shown to extend lifespan in mice by a couple of groups in recent years. So those are the four things that we're currently putting together. Wants to know about the next study that we're going to do, we've already designed it pretty much, and it's described on our website again. But we don't have funding for it yet, so anyone who fancies supporting this work, we'd be very interested to talk to you.
Let's talk about that in just one second. I have another question, though. Have I been mispronouncing telomeres for this long?
You can say telomeres or telomeres. Nobody really cares which one you say. Just as long as you spell it with one L and not two.
So this next study you're working on, what are your plans inside of that one? And you need funding for it, right?
we need it, yes. So these studies are quite expensive because they're very big.
I'll bet. Think how it's going to change humanity. I mean, the government will drop $1 billion on anything.
We believe for sure that even though these studies are expensive, they are the best bang for the buck of anything that's being done in the whole field in terms of the amount of information gained per dollar spent. So the current study cost upwards of $3.5 million, which was almost all paid up front because most of the costs are up front. It involved 1,000 mice, so that kind of gives you a feel for why it's so expensive, because we split them into 10 treatment groups. As I mentioned, we look at, you know, a treatment group that has all the mice, all the interventions, one that has none, but also ones that have subsets. And so the second study that we've planned is going to be the same format, same design, different interventions. One of them will be what's called epigenetic reprogramming, which involves various genes that were discovered about 15 years ago in Japan, that if you stimulate their expression, then cells get more stem-like. And if you do it in a carefully controlled way, then this seems to be rejuvenative. Another one is to inject
aldol. So this takes regular cells and makes them more like stem cells, which are the things that babies have.
Well, not only babies, you and I have stem cells as well, but we don't have quite such powerful ones as babies have.
And I wish I had more baby-like ones.
Well, that's right. It makes them better and or more numerous. Then there's something called albumin, which is a very abundant protein in the blood. Seems to be quite important, and we have some ideas about why it's important. We want to, again, rejuvenate the albumin in blood by injecting some pristine albumin. Then we also want to do...
Before you go on, is that the whole notion that if we take in young people's blood, that we would live longer? I mean, somehow I've seen that mice given young blood live longer.
Right. Yes. So this whole field of what you're talking about began to be exciting in the year 2005, 19 years ago now, when a group from Stanford published a very exciting study showing precisely that, that if you surgically attach a young rat to an old rat, then the circulations are mixing, then, yeah, the young rat isn't terribly happy about it, but the old rat does show various signs of rejuvenation. And so work that's gone on since then has been all about picking apart how that works, what the active ingredients are, so to speak. A lot of the work that's been done has been on the plasma, in other words, the blood without the cells in it, if you take the cells away. And there's been various promising results showing that you can get various types of rejuvenation that way, including work that I supported at my previous foundation. In addition, people are interested in the cellular component, and that's what I mentioned a moment ago with regard to the stem cells that we are incorporating during our current experiment. We're interested very much in the possibility that the cells actually matter as well, because it has been shown that there's been promising results published by other groups. And then with regard to the plasma, the question is, okay, the plasma consists of a lot of stuff. And so the question is, you know, which of the things in the plasma matter the most? And there's some evidence that albumin matters quite a lot. So that's why we are including albumin in our design for the next study. All right, then the third thing that we're going to do, that we're interested in doing this time, is we're going to be using in the diet something called deuterated fatty acids. So what is deuteration? It is simply the replacement of hydrogen atoms in a molecule with deuterium, which is heavy hydrogen with a neutron, right? So deuterium, of course, is not radioactive.
Is that helium? What is that?
No. Okay. Helium has two protons and two neutrons in its nucleus.
Thank God you're here.
Hydrogen has one proton and normally no neutrons.
Right.
But
okay.
We have a thing called heavy hydrogen, which has one proton and one neutron.
Got it. Deuterium.
Right. So it turns out that if you replace a hydrogen atom in a molecule with deuterium, then the chemical bond between that atom and whatever atom it's attached to, typically a carbon atom, is stronger and less reactive, if you like. And if you're a bit careful about which hydrogens you replace in what molecules, you can have beneficial effects. So we're working with a group that has been exploring this for nearly 20 years and has shown extremely promising results. And especially we're interested in slowing down what's called the lipid peroxidation chain reaction, which is a substantial part of aging, a very, very important aspect of aging. So that's another thing that we're doing.
So and lipids are fats of some sort. Peroxide is an oxide molecule stuck together in five, maybe?
No.
I shouldn't even try.
No, you shouldn't even try. I completely agree. A lipid peroxide is a lipid with a couple of oxygen atoms inserted into it in a way that makes it nastier and more reactive. And in particular, it turns out that rather like a nuclear explosion, these things can participate in chain reactions that make the problem a lot worse than it would be otherwise. So people have been studying this for many decades. The chemistry is very well understood. And it turns out that there are particular hydrogens. If you replace them with deuterium, this reaction more or less doesn't happen at all. And the impact, because it's like a chain reaction with a kind of critical mass, so to speak, is that you can get very beneficial effects even by replacing a rather small proportion of the fatty acids in your body by deuterated ones.
That does sound promising.
Yeah, you can do this just by ingesting them, just in the diet, rather than injecting them or anything like that.
Where do people get them?
It turns out the people, this group that I've been working with for such a long time, has developed a really nice, efficient method for creating large amounts of this stuff very inexpensively. It's not available clinically. It's not available over the counter yet, but it sure as hell will be in due course.
Okay.
All right. And then the last one is MSC. So mesenchymal stem cells. These are cells that, again, play an important regenerative role in the body. And we have fewer of them and they're less effective late in life. So we want to put young ones in. And there are various reasons to believe that these will be impactful in aging, in rejuvenation, especially because of their ability to secrete what are called exosomes. These are kind of little vesicles that transport material to other cells and help to rejuvenate the environment. So those are the four things that we're planning to do this coming time.
How long do you expect that new study to take from
Yeah, all of these studies take about the same length because we start with mice at a given age and we wait until they're dead. So
Three years, not exactly, because
we buy the mice when they're already 18 months old because that's when we want to start. So the average amount of time that our mice are expected to live in the absence of any interventions after starting from then is just on 1 year. They live to about 2.5 years. Typically, the oldest, there's always a spread of how long they live, of course. Typically, the oldest mice in a normal size study will live about 9 months longer than that. So that's like 3.25 years. Now, our goal is to extend both of those numbers, the average lifespan and the maximum lifespan, by a year. In other words, to essentially double the average lifespan starting from when we start, from 1 year out to 2 years, and to also add a year to the maximum. Ideally, we would add even more to the maximum than we would to the average, but we'll see. But also, of course, we have to use the right interventions. We don't know which ones are going to work well. And so the idea here is absolutely to do exactly this. We want to carry on doing these experiments until we achieve that threshold, that milestone level of getting a year of advance. So far, no research group has achieve more than about 4 months in terms of when you start late. If you start at like 3 months of age, then you can get a year already. But we're not really interested in that because we're interested in, helping people who have the misfortune to be already equivalent in middle age, right?
To have enough money to donate.
that's also a large part of it, yeah. We are ready to roll with this, but we need to raise $3.5-4 million to kick it off.
Well, if people want to do that, and I think it's great, what size of donations would you take? A lot of these projects are like 10,000 or more. Do you start small?
Well, this is one project, right? So we can't kick it off until we've got enough to be.
You got the $4 million.
That's right, 3.5 at least. Okay. So, in terms of the individual donations, of course, we are very happy to take whatever anyone can afford.
Okay.
We have historically, most of our funding has come from large donations, but not by no means all of it. We also have a nice large number of donors who give small amounts, so every little helps.
One can do PayPal, and I'll commit to do that within the next week. I'm going to send some, and then you can give cryptocurrency. That's probably pretty easy to send. Bank transfers and stocks and things like that, checks.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if somebody wants to donate a relatively modest amount, then definitely the right way to do it is through the website that you're seeing, the donate button on levf.org. Of course, for larger amounts, it may be advisable to get in touch with us in person beforehand. Certainly, we have, however, the ability to take any kind of format.
Well, I think this is very important. If people live longer, then we get all the good things that innovators and inventors do for a longer period. We're pushed forward in evolution, whatever that might be. And, well, it's pretty exciting to me. So I'm going to donate straight away. I would also offer that Free Talk Live, I'll do some live reads for you. I'll get some information on how people can find levf.org and go and find out more. I've subscribed to your Twitter for the organization and you, and I hope to hear more. Aubrey de Grey, this is very exciting. And the name of the foundation is it Longevity Escape Velocity Foundation?
That's right, yes. Longevity Escape Velocity is a term that I coined maybe 20 years ago. It essentially means the point where we are not necessarily completely controlling aging with medicine, but we are approaching that goal quite fast, so that we are postponing the age at which we get sick, so in other words, extending health span, faster than 1 year per year, faster than time is passing.
So that's an important point that we did not touch on, is that if you could extend life, say, 5 years, then you have five more years to extend life another 10 years, and then it leapfrogs, as it were.
That's exactly right. And I believe that the threshold that we need to achieve in order to get to longevity escape velocity is 5 years won't be enough. It's not enough time to make enough progress. But I would say 20 years is enough. If we can get, something that takes people who are, let's say, 60 or average 60-year-old in an average state of health, and let them get to 80 before coming back to being biologically 60, then 20 years is long enough so that we can give them, rejuvenation 2.0 at that point, and get them out to being 100 or 120 before they become biologically 60 the third time, and so on.
Well, this has been very exciting. Aubrey de Grey, levf.org. Please go visit the website. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thank you in advance for your donation.